Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Don't miss out on amazing end-of-sale savings on bedding, curtains and more. Available now in-store or at harrycurry.com.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Discover our new autumn collection with fresh designs and cosy colours. In-store or at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Liveline. So where on Halloween 2025, I would like to know, has all the mischief gone? When did the divilment disappear out of this day? Michael Fortune, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon.
When did it become treat or treat, in your opinion?
God, now you're putting me on the spot. I'd imagine there's a huge shift in the amount of people going out in the 70s and 80s and 90s in our urban settings. Certainly it was always begging, Philip. It was always an element of begging, going out on Halloween night. My own grandmother did it. My own mother did it. And I know a lot of people in Dublin would have went out as well with the same idea of getting money or food or whatever was going for the Halloween party. But the element of divilment was actually seems to be stronger years ago than it is now.
It explains what it is that you're interested in, Michael, which is how these traditions have evolved and changed. Because we can see, well, if you're of a certain age, we can see in the course of our lifetimes how that element of mischief, of divilment, has disappeared. And it is only now about getting dressed up and going out and getting sweets off your neighbours.
Absolutely, yeah. It's funny when you hear older people sometimes talking about, God, years ago it was everything was perfect years ago, but I've older men here that I know in Wexford, and the stories that tell you what to get up to on Halloween night, if someone, you know, playing tricks, but it was harmless enough kind of stuff now, to be fair, you know. One of the things actually, Philip, was gate lifting. That was a common one all over Ireland for some reason. It was done in America too, but it was done all over Ireland, and neighbours would literally, young lads would, I'd take Boucher Hayes' your gates, and I'd move them and swap them with Murphy's, and then, you know, my gates would be taken and be lifted up in the chapel up in the yard, and you'd get them the next day because it was All Souls' Day. But that mischief part of it was always there. Even my poor old mother, she was the most law-abiding person in the whole world, but any time I used to chat to her about Halloween, she used to always say to us, oh, no rules on Halloween night, Mick, no rules, you can do anything on Halloween night.
Kind of a paranormal element to the whole gate-lifting thing as well?
Yeah, there's stories going around, and come here to me, you can take them with pinches of salt. One of the stories was that, you know, that they were confused the spirits of where people lived, and they moved the gates. Now, I think it was just pure devilment in some cases. But certainly one of the things, of the three things that I've identified that were really strong with Halloween in Ireland, one was certainly about the dead, and one was the idea that the dead were among us. Now, that's either tonight or come All Souls Day as well, but it wasn't in a scary way. It wasn't in any shape or form in this kind of scary way. It was this kind of way. I think we're very good at keeping our dead close to us in Ireland, and people would light candles to welcome the souls back, leave the door open.
That's the tradition that underpins and is all present there, not just in Irish culture, but like across many, many cultures. But then you get down to specifics, like in the very picturesque village of Ballygarrett, which I've driven through many times, I have never stopped in. But you used to call the trick-or-treaters the wizards.
Yeah, and that's we used to call them, well, Granny in particular, we got it from her, the Wizarding Night. And it's a lovely old word. Now, it went by different names, and that's the interesting thing. Off the top of my head here now, Collykin Night, Wizarding Night, Barman's Night, Pooka Night, Snapapple Night, there were loads of names for it, all Holland. But the Wizarding One is a lovely word that survived and probably came in with the plantations. And it's Middle English, but you'll find it in French for visage, for face, and even for a motorbike helmet that people would wear now, the visor on it. So it's the idea of putting on a mask. And that was the reference to the Wizarding. You get it in Wexford and you get it in Wicklow as well. It's a Wizarding Night. All the wizards are coming, Granny would say. Even if someone had a dirty face, I heard people here in Wexford saying, look at the state of your wizard. Will you go clean your wizard, will you? I mean, go clean your face.
But it's basically, it comes down to the disguise element of the night. And you noticed, and this is again that kind of clash of culture or different traditions or how traditions evolve thing, you noticed as well that visitors to your neck of the woods had a totally different approach to dressing up than you did in Wexford.
Yeah, we'd always notice. We've a lovely term in Wexford, and I think in Louth as well. I know they're suspected of good days in Dublin, and have many cousins up there. But we always call Dublin people baiters, because it was an old term that when they came down to the sea and got into the sea back in the late 1800s, we thought we were mad. No, why would you get into the sea? So the name for a baiter stuck. So on Halloween night, there'd always be a dress up in the pub that's not there anymore in Ballygarrett, where I grew up. And all of us, we'd all dress down. And while we noticed that the poor old baiters would dress up, they'd be something. And we'd all try to be nothing, you know. So we'd throw a pillow slip on our case, or we'd on our face, or a piece of knit curtain, we'd stuff our backs. So we went to the opposite. So that was always the way it was done.
So
at
you
home.
Could tell Wexford people and Dublin people apart on Halloween night, because the object of the exercise for you was to not be recognised.
Well, that was the game. That was the crack of it. I have a video. I spent 10 years recording me mother calling to me grandmother's house. And honest to God, when we were children, she was doing this, and we thought it was right with crack altogether. Then you go older, he said. I went out in 2005, and she was still at it, and I had a camera with me. And I filmed her, and Granny was there. Who was this one now? And her mammy had put stockings on her hands and a pair of boots on her to do anything to disguise whatever even clothes they had, because people would know what clothes you wore, you know. So I went back for 10 years, and I filmed her for 10 years solid, calling up to Granny, and Granny never knew who it was. And it's a lovely, tell you what's lovely, there's an exchange that happens. I think the rural experience is different than the urban one, and I can understand why you can't have every Tom, Dick and Harry inside your house, if you're living in a housing estate. But the rural one thing, it's mad when you think about it, you can actually bring someone into your kitchen, and a complete ball man, your fellow covered up head to toe, don't know who he is, and then they'll get you to sing or dance or do something. You'll do something, or sometimes you'll do nothing, and then they'll give you something going out. And this was Granny. She was in her 90s, like into her 102nd year. Mammy was still calling up to her, a complete stranger letting into the house to act eager around the kitchen floor.
Why does Loftus Hall in Wexford have the reputation to be the most haunted place in the country?
God, isn't it mad? Do you know what? We're fascinated with stories in Ireland. And isn't it amazing to think about it? We have the ghost story. Now, that story now is not particular to Wexford. I've heard that story in Kildare and in Kerry as well. This idea of this devil bursting up through the ceiling and leaving these hoof marks in the ground. And it was funny, I was only talking to a man there today who spent time there working as a tour guide. And, you know, he'd put the hairs up in the back of your hand all the same, on the back of your arm all the same with the stories he told. I don't know how. It's you know, a mixture of tourism, a mixture of a few different things. But I think that the main attraction is storytelling. And there's something magic. I always say this. There's something special about standing in a place and to know that something happened there. Whether it's a piece of history or whether it's a piece of folklore or whether it's just a general story, there's something to irk you.
Yes.
And I suppose maybe if that seed is planted in your head about what happened in this story, well then, maybe the imagination.
Or as we in the news business would have to say, something that allegedly happened there when the devil himself disappeared into a puff of smoke. Andy Downs, good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, how's it going?
Loftus Hall and the story of its haunting has made something of a social media influencer out of you.
It has. By quite an accident, I was going there just to keep my missus happy. She's big into her haunted stories and anything to do with Halloween or ghost stories, anything like that. So my main focus is Irish stone lifting. So just to keep her happy, we were on a bit of an adventure, and I said we'd stop into Loftus Hall.
Is this a mixed relationship? She was into her haunted houses, you were into your stone lifting, and somebody was going to have to make a concession.
That's it, yeah. Happy wife, happy life. So, it's kind of widely accepted to be Ireland's most haunted house. There's a number of ghost stories and haunted stories attached to Loftus Hall.
Well, tell us the famous one that made you 1.3 million views famous.
Yes, so it's the story of a stranger arriving to Loftus Hall on a stormy night. I know a lot of these spooky stories start with a stormy night. But there was a stranger arrived on horseback to Loftus Hall, they say, in 1775, seeking shelter on a stormy night. And they brought the stranger in. He was very charismatic. They got on great with him, had a few drinks, and they were sitting down playing a game of cards. And the daughter of the landowner, her name was Anne Tottenham, Anne became besotted with this stranger. And in the middle of a game of cards, Anne dropped a card. And when she bent down to retrieve the card, she looked underneath the table and she saw that this stranger, he hadn't feet, but he had cloven hooves. So when she saw this, she let out a scream, and The stranger then revealed himself as the devil, supposedly, and burst into a ball of flames and shot up through the ceiling. And apparently to this day, there's still a hole in the ceiling that can't be repaired, no matter how many times they've tried to repair it, in the roof of Loftus Hall.
Now, in this context, Andy, what does apparently mean? Did you stand under the hole? Did you get wet as the rain came through it?
No, I haven't actually been inside the house. The house was recently bought, and it was being done up into a luxury hotel. But the construction has since stopped, and it's back on the market again now for, I think, $2.5 million.
Ooh.
But while I was there, now it has been gutted.
Okay.
Now, whether that's the curse as to why the construction stopped, but after that, Anne like descended into madness. She was then confined into the tapestry room in the house, where she just sat day after day in the fetal position and wouldn't eat any food. But I think it was the following year then Anne was said to have died in the tapestry room. And because she spent so long in that fetal position, her bones had fused. So when they were trying to bury her, they couldn't straighten her body. So they actually had to custom build a coffin around her body. And this was confirmed, I think, in the late 1800s. There was workers... They were doing some renovation works on the family vault, and when they opened it up, they actually saw the strange-looking coffin belonging to Anne inside. So that story was actually confirmed.
Go away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He said, and with his tongue firmly in his cheek. And did anybody ever manage to explain why it is, when the handsome stranger came riding up to the house, that nobody noticed the cloven hooves as he walked through the hall? Were they just too polite to mention it?
Maybe
very unobservant?
He probably kicked off his riding boots in the middle of the game of cards.
Let me bring in one of Wexford's most famous sons, Owen Colfer. Good afternoon. How are you?
How do you, Philip? How's it going?
You have more than a relationship with Loftus Hall. It's something of a muse in the Artemis Fowl series of books and stories.
I've managed to shoehorn Loftus Hall into several books. I remember the first time I tried it was I was trying to do a picture book for kids, and so I submitted this story about the devil shooting up through the roof on a pillar of flame, and I was told, no, we cannot have this for six-year-olds. So I swapped it with a pirate, so it became the legend of Captain Crow's Teeth. But it's the same story, essentially, because as a teenager I worked there when it was a bar briefly. So,
and was there a hole in the roof letting in water?
Well, it was patched, but you could see where it had been patched. So I suspect perhaps the carpenters just turned the planks the other way, so they were perpendicular.
But this obviously did something to the imagination of the teenage Owen Colfer.
Well, it was like they went straight to the devil. Like most ghost stories are about a ghost, but Loftus Hall went straight to the top, yeah, and they enlisted the devil. But also when you're coming down the Hook Peninsula and you come up on top of the rise of the hill and you look down that road, which is called the road that killed the beggarman because it's so long, straight and flat, you can see this gothic looking mansion house sitting back from the road. And for all the world, it looks like something out of a Hammer House of Horror. And I think that's why the legend seems so believable. When you're walking home from the disco in feathers and you're 15 or 16 at 2 o'clock in the morning and all you can see backlit by the lighthouse is Loftus Hall, you just tend to believe these things.
Well, no, you do a good job describing it, because anybody would reasonably quicken their pace along that stretch of road at that time of night.
And the addition to the legend for us was that if you're walking down there and there's a light on in Loftus Hall, then the devil is in that window looking for his next soul. Now, so that was what was in our head. And we had one friend who used to lie in wait for people and jump out at them. And one night he jumped out at us swinging. This is true. He jumped out swinging a dead cat over his head.
Oh.
I don't know where that came into the legend.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I asked the question at the beginning of the programme, where has all the mischief gone? Maybe it's
there
best well gone, if that's the kind of mischief people are going to be getting up to. So the Fowl Hall in the Artemis Fowl books, is it Loftus Hall?
Yeah. It's
absolutely
totally based on Loftus Hall. Yeah, and even in the descriptions in the book, how it's, you know, set back from the road, and the pillars and the gargoyles, everything. It's all Loftus Hall, yeah.
And your dad, the teacher and the historian, introduced you to the archaeological remains of Viking Wexford under the town. That plays a role in the books too.
Everything, like my dad was great for me, because he brought us out to the Salty Islands, for example, and that became then the islands in Airman, because he said there's a king of the Salty Islands, or there was a king of the Salty Islands. So in my mind, that became like a real region. And so I set turned the century kingdom on the Salty Islands. And the Vikings, of course, in Wexford town, Dad used to do Wexford walks, which Paul Walsh is doing the Wex walks now. But and he would show us where the Vikings lived and how narrow the roads were, why that was important. And then my brother became an archaeologist, another brother became an architect, and I wrote about it in fiction. So he gave one kind of gift to everybody.
So the whole underworld of the Artemis Fowl novels is based on this notion that was playing around in your head as a child of there being a whole different Viking city underneath modern-day Wexford.
Exactly, and it seemed to me that if the fairies were to survive, where would they go? They'd go down. So, but that was based on the idea that there was this sub-city underneath Wexford. And in my mind, the ghosts of Vikings were still roaming around under the town.
So this is you at work doing exactly what we were talking about with Michael there a second ago, evolving these traditions, changing these traditions, modernising them with each generation. They're never going to stay the same, are they?
No, and you just extrapolate, you know, what would have happened in the last 50 or 100 years. I always thought, you know, if the fairies were to survive, they would have to be more technologically advanced. So my fairies are different from, for example, Jim Fitzpatrick's fairies. And I'm sure the next generation will put their own add-ons on. But hopefully that will keep the legends alive and keep the stories alive.
Time to get inter-county competitive about this, because we have been focused a little bit too much exclusively on Wexford. Nothing wrong with that, says Owen Colfer and Michael Fortune. But let me bring Kieran Fanning into the conversation. Kieran's the author of Irish Fairy Tales, Myths and Legends. Good afternoon, Kieran. How are you?
Not too bad, Philip. How are you?
Your favourite Halloween ghost story, devil story, demonic possession story, or whatever it is, please.
Well, I was going to do the Loftus Hall one, but you've covered that.
We can't do Wexford. There's 31 other counties.
In County Down, the most famous haunted house there was called Gill Hall. And it was built in the 1670s and it survived for nearly 300 years before burning down. But prior to that, it became a haunted house that people paid money to go in to see. And there's a great story behind it. It's the story of Lady Nicola Beresford, who, when she was a child with her cousin, she was they were always chatting about all things in the afterlife. And they really wanted to know what came after when you died. And they made a deal with each other. They said, whichever of us dies first will come back from the dead to haunt the other person, just to prove there is an afterlife. And if we don't come back, then there must be no afterlife. So anyway, the two kids grew up and they went their separate ways. But one night, Nicola was visiting her sister in Gill Hall. And she woke up in the bedroom and she felt everything was covered in frost and her breath was turned to a kind of smoky fog and everything was really cold. And she wondered, did she leave the window open? And then she saw this ghostly figure at the bottom of the bed and she recognized it was her cousin and she hadn't seen him in years. And she was saying to him, how are you here? And he said, well, something terrible has happened to me. And she said, what? And he said, well, I've died. I died yesterday. And she said, that couldn't be. And then he had to prove it to her. So he put his hand down on the desk beside her and left this blackened print. And she said, she was dubious, you know, she said, that could be a trick. So he touched her, he grabbed her wrist. And when he grabbed her wrist, it singed the sinews in her arm and blackened her wrist. And then she knew it was true. And she asked him lots of things. She was quite unhappy herself because she wasn't getting along with her husband because she hadn't been able to get pregnant. And he reassured her because he was in the afterlife. He knew the future. He said, you're going to have a child. And he said, but there is tragedy ahead of you as well. Your husband will die. And she was upset by this. But then he said, but you will marry again. And then she was kind of curious that he knew all these things. And she said, well, if you know everything, can you tell me how long will I live? And he said, well, I know, but I'm not going to tell you because that would ruin your life if you knew. And she plagued him and plagued him. And she had a way, she always had a way of getting around him. And he eventually told her that you would die on your 47th birthday, which in those days was a kind of decent enough age. So anyway, when the morning came, she wrapped a black ribbon around her wrist and went down to her sister. And her sister said, what are you doing with a ribbon around the wrist? And she said, you must never ask me about this ribbon again. And all her life she wore this ribbon. And anybody that knew her never asked her.
You must never ask me about this black ribbon that I am wearing around my wrist in a way that invites questions. But yes, go on.
Yeah, but anyway, the things came to pass that our cousin had predicted. She did have a child. Her husband died and she remarried again. But then coming up to her 47th birthday, she was very worried. She said, you know, this is the end. She knew she was going to die. So she held a big party. No, she didn't. She went into hiding because she couldn't face it. And as the night ticked on, she locked herself into her bedroom and she knew this was the end. But it reached midnight and she was still alive. And the next day she was dubious. She had survived the curse. And for the whole following year, she was so happy that she had made it past her 47th birthday that on her 48th birthday, she decided to throw a huge party to celebrate. And who did she invite? Only the priest that had baptized her. And he came into the party and he said, happy 47th birthday. And she said, oh, no, no, that was last year. It's my 48th birthday. And he said, oh, no, it's not, because I just checked the church records because I wasn't sure. And she had got the date wrong. And it was her 47th birthday. And when she heard this, she ran everybody from the room and sent them all home and locked herself in the bedroom. And her children eventually came in and sat around her. And she started feeling sleepy and ill. And she knew this was the end. And she told the two children the whole story. She told them the story about her cousin, about her wrist. And she died that night. And afterwards, that house, Gill Hall, was a tourist attraction. People paid a half penny, I think, to go in. And interestingly enough, years later, in Hoat Castle, a painting of Lady Beresford turned up. And on her wrist had been painted over. But if you could kind of see through the paint that there was a black ribbon on it, underneath the paint. Somebody had painted over it. So it's curious and spooky. And that was probably the spookiest story from the north of Ireland.
That's a good one and well told. Before I let you go, I want you to tell me about Alice Keitler, the Witch of Kilkenny.
Alice Keitler, yeah. And Keitler's Inn is still in the centre of Kilkenny, and it's supposedly haunted. I've spoken to the staff there, and the staff do report noises and things moving and doors banging. But Alice Keitler was, and interestingly enough, it's the anniversary of... Alice Keitler was basically a businesswoman, and she married a moneylender. And curiously enough, soon after she married him, he died. And she inherited his business and his assets. So she got married again and she married another moneylender. And guess what happened? he popped his slugs as well. And then she married for a third time. And this guy was a wealthy landowner. And guess what? He also died. So by now, the people of Kilkenny were kind of very suspicious about this woman who had growing wealth, was rising up in status in the centre of Kilkenny. Very bad luck with men, but a lot of people were suspicious about her, and especially the Bishop Ledred, and he sent his...
Bishop Ledred? Are you serious?
Ledred, yeah.
Ledred.
Yeah, yeah. and he sent his... a court of inquisition, they were called. They were like a kind of a armed force for the church to investigate. And before they reached her, she had married a fourth time. And by now, everybody was sure she was a witch because people had seen her maid, who was called Petronella de Mead, mixing potions in her shop. And she also had a black cat. And cats were they were considered kind of dangerous and kind of portents of evil in those days.
Okay, but before you go on, has history recorded and passed down to us how stupid the fourth husband was?
Stupid, but by all accounts, Alice was a very attractive lady and a very charming lady. Mm. She was also extremely wealthy. Like, she kind of owned the centre of Kilkenny. People came into it, and then she was She was the lady about town. She was the celebrity of Kilkenny.
All right, well, anyway, back to the maid. Back to the maid, Petronella Demead.
Petronella Demead had been kind of homeless in Kilkenny with her own daughter, and Alice had taken her in and showed her herbology, which was kind of a new art, and she was showing her how to make medicines and cures. And so Petronella had been seen do this. But anyway, the Court of Inquisition from the church turned up at her door and knocked on the door and arrested Alice Kittler. And Alice Kittler was taken to Kilkenny Castle and thrown in a dungeon there. And she was told she could have one visitor. And she didn't ask for her son William because she didn't want to get him involved in this. So she asked for her maid, Petronella Demead. And when Petronella heard this, she knew she had to do something. She owed her life to Alice, and she said, "I will come visit you, and I will bring you more than cheese." So she put on a cloak, and she headed to the castle, and she wrapped a scarf around her face, because this is just like COVID times. At the time, there was a huge epidemic, a coughing fever, and everybody was coughing. And she went up to the guard coughing and said, "I'm here to visit Alice Kittler." And the guard, of course, didn't want to go near her, so he opened the door and pushed her inside. But when she was inside, they switched cloaks, and Alice escaped coughing. So the guard opened the door, and out went Alice. And Petronella Demead was captured, and she was burned at the stake on the 3rd of November. I'm trying to remember the date now.
1324 is what I have here.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So it's the anniversary this Monday. And she was the first witch to be burned at the stake in Ireland. But, you know, after that, there were 50,000 women across the world were burned at the stake for being witches, you know.
Yeah.
And it was really, you know, it was really...
It's a cruel story, that one, now. Because, I mean, yes, you say Petronella Demead did what she did voluntarily, but one suspects there might have been a little bit of influence brought to bear by Alice Kittler, who, by all accounts, was obviously a very persuasive woman. So for my money, yeah, the Witch of Kilkenny, Alice Kittler, is a winner. I know you like the story from Down, from Gill Hall. Kieran Fanning, have you a regional favourite to contend? Kieran?
From where?
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. I beg your pardon. I meant to say Michael. Michael, have you got something that will rival the cruelty of Alice Kittler?
Well, all I can say is Kilkenny people for you. That's all a Western man can say. But come here to me. Listen, I do remember a story in Mayo. No, it's not a long story. I'll keep it very short. A lot of those stories, when they were invented, and how they were invented, and why they were invented.
Invented, Michael? Are you saying that they're not true?
Absolutely. There's a great one from Tureen Dance Hall up in County Mayo, and I was up recording in Mayo 20 years ago, and they told me about this story. Now, again, T.G. Carter did a documentary on it as well. But the story was that someone opened up a private dance hall anyway, and it didn't go down well with local authorities. So someone of the cloth apparently put out a story that the devil, some young girl, got up to dance with someone, and she looked down, and what did you see, Tony, dancing? Beside her was a man with cloven hoofed feet, and apparently shot.
Which nobody else had noticed at any point throughout the entire evening. So many unobservant people in this country, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And and you know what? The dance hall closed down because of the power of that story. So no, but I won't be able to better any of those stories.
Okay.
But I can tell you what people did, what people didn't do in County Wexford, Mafayette, and Halloween night all day long.
Well, I'll come back to that. Let me bring in Aoife Granville, folklorist. Oh, God, look at the time. Hang on a second. I have to take a break and earn some money, and then I'm going to talk to Aoife Granville. We'll come back in a few minutes.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815. Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Folklorist Aoife Granville, good afternoon.
Hello, how are you?
Maybe I'm being a little bit cynical in the way that I'm interpreting these stories, but Michael's story about the devil appearing in Tureen Dance Hall and it then being used as an excuse to close it down, it seems that there's the dread hand of authority or the establishment using a lot of Halloween stories for their own purposes. Did we repurpose these stories to achieve certain desirable social ends, do you think, Aoife?
Well, I think, and I was really enjoying those stories there. I said I'm no storyteller. I was hoping you weren't going to ask me to tell a story as well as the lads. But, like, I think there is a lot of, in some of the stories now, we would have been told, for example, our dad was always telling us stories when we were young, especially on Iha Hauna, were kind of, would lead you to be a bit more mindful about going out after dark, for example, and that type of thing, maybe talking to strangers. So we would often have been told stories around, I think every Bohareen and every part of West Kerry, there's a story about meeting a man or a spirit or someone else after dark, and, you know, that might have been a person that had actually passed away, you know, you'd find out afterwards. So there definitely is, like, lessons to be learned, I think, in a lot of our stories. But that connection with the other world, I think, is particularly strong with stories that are to do with Iha Hauna and a lot of the traditions we have, you know. And for me, I suppose, tonight, for our ancestors, I suppose, this was the start of the new year, Iha Hauna, dusk tonight, as opposed to our New Year's Day now. And there was a particular connection with the other world and people that had passed. And for me growing up, it wasn't like scary stories and things like that, but more a mindfulness and an awareness that the other world was, there was another world there.
A celebration of those who have passed. And it's funny, isn't it, that we now tell that story about the veil between this world and the other world being at its thinnest on this night, as if that protection is lost. But you're saying that in your childhood, this was the moment that the greatest connection with those who had died was possible.
Yeah. And I think that's something that, you know, and I think you mentioned it earlier, or someone mentioned it there, you know, even in the Christian calendar, the All Souls, and November is the month that people are praying, especially for the dead, especially those that have passed on recently. And there was that belief. I know my own grandmother would have believed that very strongly, that tonight, you know, I suppose people would talk to people or pray to them or whatever it was. And I think that's the connection that's there for me mostly with the other world, but also mindfulness. I mean, and tonight, like, I'm a musician as well, and there's a lot of music that's connected with the happenings tonight, and sort of more activity around Listena, the fairy forts, and stories around that, where music could be heard or music could be passed on to someone on Iha Hauna from the other world, you know. And there's a wonderful composer, fiddle player from County Clare, Junior Crehan, and a lot of his compositions were connected with the other world and meeting someone on the road on the way home, and the Lúrhadán, which is kind of a small little man like a leprechaun. That's one of the famous jigs in our tradition now, I suppose, played a lot. And that was passed on from someone he met on the way home.
Come here, though. that's something that's common. You actually probably thought about this, Owen Colfer. That meeting the fella at the crossroads, or meeting somebody at the Boreen on the way home, or meeting somebody as you walk through the woods, that's common to so many different cultures. The American Deep South, or ancient medieval England. It's not just an Irish invention.
I think a lot of them are an extension of the morality tales where, you know, it's a warning, don't be gambling, playing cards, or the devil might show up. You know, don't go to a dance. Don't be dancing, and don't be going out at night and talking to strangers at crossroads. So it's all, I think they're all little warnings to the young kids who might be listening to them.
So it is all about social control. Was that the thing that kind of inspires you to take these stories and subvert them, turn them on their head?
Well, I mean, for me, it was really just, if I'm going to use these stories, and if I'm going to use this mythological character, I have to present something new. So the best way to do that is just to subvert it. And so instead of the leprechaun being a small, you know, funny man in a suit, I make him a very modern female police person. And it just to turn it all around and give it a bit of new life for my generation, but it's 25 years ago since that came out. So I'm sure there's a whole new generation of young writers.
I did your first broadcast interview with you.
You were only a young fella. We were both, as were you.
Now, I like to think that you went on to greater and better things because of that interview.
That was it. That's what I always say. If it wasn't for Philip in 2001.
Yeah, it's funny you haven't said that in any of the royalties checks, though, isn't it, Owen?
Yeah. Well, I'll make that up to you if you accept payment in Guinness. I'll make that right.
Can I go back to you, Kieran Fanning? I have a particular attraction to the story of the black pig of Kiltrustan in Roscommon. Do you remember that one?
I do. It was 1919. Girls in the village had spotted these black pigs that came out of the ground. They came out of a hole in the ground. And they called the local school teacher over, and he couldn't see anything. And they were saying, look, the pigs are on the ground. Look, they're right at your feet. They're at your shoes. And he said, oh, these girls are playing tricks on me. So he called over another man that was walking by, and he said, do you see the pigs? And all the adults turned up and nobody saw the pigs. So they got all the kids, but the kids could all see the pigs and the adults couldn't. So the only way to really find out if it was true was to bring in a child from another village that knew nothing about it. So somebody went off and got another child and brought them to the village and brought them to the site where supposedly the pigs were snuffling around on the ground. And the child, sure enough, could see these pigs. And that story made the front page of the Western Roscommon Messenger on the 4th of May 1918.
That's a little bit mad, isn't it? Because, I mean, we're in the modern era here, and presumably there were some sceptical grown-ups investigating this story. Or do you think everybody was leaning into something fanciful?
Well, you see, there had been kind of predictions made by St. Colum Kill that a black pig would be an evil omen of something bad to come, and it would foretell of wars to come. And sure enough, war did come, you know.
Oh, it was 1919, you said? Oh, God, okay, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, because when it happened, a woman came out with a book that with this prophecy from St. Colum Kill, you know, and other people then agreed. And somebody else brought a book out by William Francis de Visme Cain, who also had this legend that St. Patrick battled with an ancient demon and turned this demon at that site into a black pig. And the pig disappeared into the ground. And this was the reappearance of the pig, you know. So I think you can always find a way to believe anything or find evidence to back up a belief.
Andy Downs, obviously your Loftus Hall TikTok with 1.3 million views was your most popular to date. What's the second most popular?
Probably the second most would be Oneagat Cave. It's located, again, in County Roscommon there.
This is the portal, the opening to hell, Oneagat.
Exactly. Now you have it. So it's located in the Rathcrone complex. So that would have been the ancient capital of Connacht. And it features a lot in Irish mythology. But the folklore around this cave, so like it's a natural limestone cave. I think it stretches back about 30 to 40 metres. But the entrance to the cave is actually a man-made souterrain. Now, how old that is, I don't know, but there is a lintel over the front door or over the entrance of it that is an Oum stone that was repurposed. And the Oum stone dates back about 1,500 years. It's got the inscription Freyr, son of Maeve, on the stone. Yeah. But the folklore behind this is that the cave was basically the portal to the other world. And on Halloween, October 31st, the veil between worlds became thin. And the goddess Morrigan was said to open the portal to the other world. And all of these demons would flow into the land. And it was kind of like symbolic of winter coming. These demons, they'd come out and they would strip all the leaves off the trees. They'd send frost everywhere. Animals would start to die off. So it was very symbolic of winter coming in. And as part of like a defense against these evil spirits, the people used to light bonfires. So that's where the whole bonfires on Halloween come from. They used to stay in the light and the heat as a form of protection. And then as a sort of a deception, then they used to dress up as ghouls so that the spirits would leave them alone. They thought they were one of their own, you know?
Yeah. Come here. Can I ask an old fart kind of question about how the younger generation on TikTok are engaging with these stories? Are they sceptical about them? Are they saying, go on, pull the other one? Or are they embracing them?
I think they're embracing them. I think there's a huge like reclamation at the moment from the younger generation of everything Irish culture, be it folklore, Irish music, Irish sports. So I think there's a real interest in it now. Whether people believe it or not, I don't know. But it's very plausible that that is the origins of Samhain, which became Halloween. That's very plausible, because like that.
Indeed. Okay, let me bring in. Let me bring in Jim Simmons here. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you?
I'm very well, and thank you very much for having me on the programme.
No, well, thank you for calling. You have a ghost story, a 100%, no word of a lie, genuinely true ghost story.
Absolutely. And it's the only ghost story I ever heard that two of us saw the very same thing, right?
Okay, set the scene, please. Go for it.
Right. It was a summer's evening, the very end of May or the beginning of June, 1969, and I was sitting in the living room of a house in Greenmount in Cork City, in the company of a wonderful young woman. And it began to get dusky, you know, it began to get dark, and the street lights came on outside. And it was most pleasant. It wasn't dark, but it was twilight. It was the gloaming, I suppose you'd call it. And I idly looked across the living room to the knob or the handle of the door that led out onto the hallway. And slowly, the left hand of an old woman slipped around the door from the hallway, covered the doorknob. No, it was just a shadowy form. I mean, I could actually still see the doorknob. Covered the doorknob, came in, went back out again in hardly 4 seconds, I'd say. Then the lovely, beautiful lady that was with me, she began to get nervous. And I said, God, what's wrong with you? I said, you're a bag of nerves. Didn't you see it? She said to me. I said, you mean the hand? And she said, oh, Jesus, yes. Says she, right? Now, in other words, I was confirming what she saw and vice versa. She said, get me out of here fast. So I opened the door out onto the hallway where the hand came.
You put your hand on that door handle?
Of course I did.
Oh, Jim, you're a brave man.
Maybe I was. But I had to, I suppose. Well, the door was ajar anyway for the hand to come around, the shadowy hand to come around. Like, so, anyway.
Nobody else in the house, Jim? Nobody else?
No, just myself and this goddess of a young woman. So anyway, I stayed with my back to the hallway and the stairwell and that, and I opened the front door and she slipped out onto the fresh air. So then I said to her, look, this is important. I said, I was kind of had a bit of a scientific brain, I suppose. You know, I was studying science in UCC at the time. Anyway, I said, no, I said, questions. I said, I know you're in bed, you're a bit nervous now and everything, but, says I, a few questions, I said. And these were the questions, not necessarily in order now. Was the left hand of a person's left or right hand? Was the thumb up or the thumb down? Like, she said, it was the left hand. Correct, says I. Now, I'm going to say the next thing to you. I'm telling you, I saw a woman's hand. That's right, it was a woman's hand, she said. Next question for you, I said, was it an old woman or a young one? She said, an old woman. Grand, says I. Next question for me, was there a left hand, was there a wedding ring on the ring finger? No, she said. And then I said to her, no, it couldn't have been, because the ring that was on that finger is now on the ring finger of your right hand, because I think that was your mother's hand you saw. And she said, yes, I recognize it as my mother's hand. So that's the end of the story.
Good God.
Yeah.
So if it was a trick of the light, Jim, you were both tricked by the light in the same way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, but hang on a second. The most crucial question here is that did this otherworldly intervention stop you from getting the shift that night?
You're very bold. Well, to be honest.
Was it her way out, do you think, perhaps, of your amorous advances?
No, all the amorous stuff was kind of finished at that stage, like, you know what I mean? Everything,
Yeah. That's all right. No, we can draw a discreet veil over the rest. I just had to ask in the, you know, in the name of science, yeah, as you say, to get all of the facts absolutely straight. Well, Jim, you tell a great story.
Yeah, and the following week I was over in America, in New York, working. I went over there for my summer holidays, you know. But she met my daughter decades later, and her child was good on the stage, as was my daughter. And she said, Elaine Simmons, she said, is your dad's name Jim? She said, yes. Well, tell him I often think fondly of him, and I've nothing, only nice things to say about him. Fair play to her.
Very good, very good. Yeah. Jim, thank you very much for the call. Good luck to you. Take care. Michael Fortune.
God bless, and thank you.
No, thank you.
Was I on the radio there? I was.
Ah, yeah. I wish somebody had explained that to you before now. You can listen back online to confirm it as well. There's no need for paranormal investigators to go and check that one out for you. All right, Jim.
God bless us.
Great story, great story. Take care of yourself. Bye-bye. Well, I suppose it has been a little bit confusing, the number of people sitting in this chair in the course of the last few weeks to remember who it is you're talking to. Michael, bring me back to the tradition of the mask wearing. What did you want to say about that?
Yeah, no, that was a lovely piece of radio there. There's a story. There's a really good map, actually, by the way, Philip. Kevin Danaher made it back in the 40s. It's a great visual of the map of Ireland. The whole mask wearing thing around Halloween wasn't widespread, and there's a kind of ask me your stories, get out, and stories grow legs, and sure, who might pull them back in? But it was predominantly, I'd say, a handful of counties around Leinster, and then a few smidgens around Ulster, and a few in Connacht, and a tiny bit in Munster. And I know we love claiming things in Ireland as well, but I just want to say that the neighbours over in the Isle of Man and Scotland and parts of England, they did the dressing up at Halloween as well. And also they did the same over in Holland and Germany with St. Martin's Night. But I won't bore you to tears with that. But I heard one of the previous speakers talking about the mask wearing thing, it wasn't widespread at all, as people think it is. The evidence isn't there. And I'd even see it in my own native Wexford. The people in South Wexford didn't go out dressed up. By my own grandmother and them up North Wexford, they did.
But the thing is, I mean, for people like you, keeping abreast of all of these traditions, which seem to be changing with every single generation, this festival is being given a twist or reinvented or in some way changing. How can you keep track of it?
You don't. You've got to go with it and enjoy it. Like, I have three young children here tonight, and when the first question you asked me there at 1:45 was about divilment, and my little one in the car said to me earlier on today, I said, I can't wait to go down to wrap up gates, me grandparents' gates. So
it's returning then. Because,
of course, well, there's little things. Yeah, they do. Things change and move on and twist and in their own little way, you know. My own mother would have worn...
We never moved gates, because I have to say, around us, gates were held in place with so much baling twine and brambles and barbed wire and everything that you wouldn't be taking a gate down off its post to do that. But we went around with sackfuls of toilet paper to wrap around people's cars or throw over the roofs or around the bushes, the trees, the hedges around the house. And that's something that's a very wasteful use of toilet paper. But that's completely disappeared now, hasn't it? Let me bring in Stephen here. Good afternoon, Stephen. How are you?
I'm good, Philip. I presume I'm on the radio, am I?
Oh, you are on the radio. Let's be clear about this. This is a phone-in show, and people end up on the radio when they phone 0818715815. So, Stephen, you used to know the owners of Loftus Hall.
We did, yeah. My one of my sons was very friendly with the family down there. They owned Loftus Hall for a while, type of thing. We'd been down a couple of times past, but then when they opened it up, they allowed people in to visit, and we got the whole story about the game of cards, type of thing, you know. But the funny thing with us was, and the interesting thing is, there's a stairway in there that's identical to the one that was on the Titanic.
Really?
It's twin, apparently, yeah.
It's twin?
The stairway.
It's actual twin?
Yeah, apparently, that's what we were told, yeah. The stairway is identical to the one that was on the Titanic.
Well, that's spooky enough in and of itself. Never mind the devil coming and playing cards.
It's stunning, but the funny part of our visit was that they brought it into another room. They tore the house up in a place that were open, and we went into this large room, and there was only the single thing that was in it. It was darkly lit, and there was one single hospital bed. You know the old hospital bed you saw in the 1950s, 1960s?
Yeah.
On the TV, so everything, one of them, in the middle of the floor. And the story, there was an organ over in the far side. It was a harmonium, one of those ones you push, you pedal type of thing to get the sound out of it. And about 15 of us in the room, and they just told the whole story about the person dying in the bed type of thing. We went out thinking, Gene, that's a bit weird type of thing, you know. Well, Magella had stayed back, and she went over to play the harmonium, not realizing there was another guy was straggling behind. So I'd gone out, and there was only him left in the room. He didn't see Magella, my wife, gone over to the harmonium to play the, see if it was working. Well, she blasted out a few tunes, a few notes. The next thing, your man ran out. He ran out of the room. He didn't know what to do.
Oh, God. And his hair turned white and he was never seen again.
Really good. Oh, it was so funny, you know. I said to Magella,
not if you were him.
What happened?
All right, Stephen. Thank you very much. I need to take another break here.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815. Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Owen Colfer is still listening in. Are you gathering material for the next book, Owen?
This is fantastic. I've got a trilogy so far. So
I don't suppose we'll be seeing any royalties out of that one either, though, will we?
There'll be a lot of Guinness going into RTE.
So come here, give me your favourite piece of Irish folklore, apart from the stories that you've already told us, that has found its way into Artemas Fowl.
Well, I think for me, Artemas Fowl is based, I suppose, very directly on one of the oldest stories, which is the naughty boy who captures the leprechaun and then has to try and trick the crafty leprechaun out of the crock of gold. And that's what Artemas Fowl is about. He's the naughty boy, and then Holly Short is the leprechaun, and he spends 8 books trying to get the crock of gold, because if he got it straight away, I'd have no career. So it had to take him like 8 books to do that. And I owe that a huge debt. And growing up, reading people like Patricia Lynch and aforementioned Jim Fitzpatrick, that really shaped the kind of thing I wanted to write. And I think Jim Fitzpatrick in particular, because he took a whole new avenue on the leprechauns and fairies, in that they weren't these tiny creatures flitting around the garden. They were these very glamorous, muscly, fighting creatures. And that really appealed to me, because I thought you could take the old figures and do something new with them. And that's what I tried to do then 20 years later.
But God, Owen, isn't it great to be Irish and to grow up steeped in all of this? I know every nation has its own culture, but we have something special. And we are
absolutely
steeped, yeah.
And I always thought that, you know, because when I grew up, and I'm sure the same as you, the legends of Cú Chulainn and whatever and Fiamma Cúil were part of the history curriculum in primary school. So one week you'd be reading about 1916, and then the next week, side by side, you would have how did Cú Chulainn get his name. And as far as I was concerned back then, they were all equally true. And I just presumed that every nation had their version of that. But as, when I started traveling around, touring with the books, I would ask people, now, what's your legend? And a lot of the time, they wouldn't know, because it wasn't taught in the schools. And you'd find out that some countries wouldn't have any fairies, and then others might have one, whereas we had thousands, you know. And every child in Ireland still knows most of those stories. And it's a great gift to us, I think.
It is. And Aoife, it's not just different cultures, but different towns end up being steeped in very different traditions in this country, because obviously where you are in Dingle, Stephen's Day and the Wren Boys and the Mummers is a massive, massive tradition, but you're not so hot on Halloween there, are you?
Well, I mean, yeah, I guess, and Michael was mentioning Kevin Danaher's map and, you know, where guising was popular. And I mean, we probably trick-or-treated a small bit when we were younger on Halloween, but we're obsessed with the Ran on 26th of December in Dingle. For us, definitely, it was in the home on Halloween night, Iha Hauna, that was more important in Dingle, certainly in, and that would have been most of my friends as well. And today now there would be very little trick-or-treaters around the town tonight, but the games and stuff in the home were very important to us, do you know, the forecasting games and the bobbing apples and the telling of stories. I think often, is that happening in the home nowadays? Like, I'd encourage people, you know, if there are kids at home, to try and get them going on the games, because they're lovely, lovely games around Halloween, you know, and all of that. But yeah, we rarely went trick-or-treating. As an adult, there was a couple of fancy dress parties we indulged in, all right, in pubs and stuff. But yeah, different.
You were too busy practicing your broom dancing in preparation for the 26th of December. Michael, let me come back to you one final thing here, because I shut you down, and I shouldn't have, on the different food traditions. How many different ways are there in this country of doing Culcannon around this time of year?
Oh, Lord, you're going to start a civil war here now. It's lovely. Actually, it's lovely listening to Aoife. I, everything she's saying, I kind of concur with. The idea of games and all that would be at a private element to me, that it makes Halloween as well. You have a very public element and a very private one. But I will answer your question with regard to Halloween, to Culcannon. To me, Culcannon, I'm itching now to get back down to the kitchen, I'll be honest with you. I always put on a big pot of Culcannon tonight on Halloween night, and so did the mother and so did the grandmother and all the neighbours around me. And it was always a dish that was put on, and to me, tonight wouldn't be the same without the smell of it going through the house. And it was a simple, Halloween was a harvest festival, and that's why children went out looking for nuts and apples off their neighbours and things like that. And actually, one of the little things, actually, by the way, Philip, and I have you, was the old people would always tell you not to pick any sloes or blackberries or apples after tonight, because the pooka would be out, or the fairies were out doing their business on them. So there was a little warning to children. But for me, the Culcannon...
Again, but that comes back to what Aoife was saying about there being a social purpose there, because by this time, the blackberries... Well, sorry, before the climate started getting warmer into the end of October, into November, by this stage, the blackberries should be long gone.
Absolutely, yeah. Some people said Michaelmas Day, the 29th of September, was the date to cut off. But I found a lot of people recording up in Mayo and Wexford and Offaly here. They always said the November's night or Halloween night was the night for it. And it made sense. It was even a little verse, and I won't repeat it on radio for you, but it goes like this. Halloween night, pooka, and then you can fill in the blank yourself. A woman whose granny came from Mayo told me that. That was a little verse. It's set in their head, and they knew then not to pick anything. But here's the one thing. The food is such an important thing for Halloween. And I'm going to mention this to you with my regards to Culcannon and Wexford. Our Culcannon was always a one-pot job, right? No 15 pots and parboiling and 10 ovens. We had spuds and onions, because there was no scallions in late October. We had cabbage. We didn't use kale in Wexford. And then the secret ingredient to a Wexford Culcannon would always be a couple of parsnips. And that would be put on a little low heat and boiled up. And then as children, then I'd be doing this tonight myself. You'd always slip a few coins into it then for the children. And that was done in Wexford, but it was also done in Dublin and Meath and Westmeath.
And when did we stop slipping the other things in there? The stick and the lump of coal or clay. This was the stuff that went into the barn brack, because we've just reduced it to the ring in the barn brack now, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. I suppose marriage, Philip, is the ultimate goal in life, isn't it? And for some, but we did, like, the barn bracks in the past. The old people who made the barn bracks here, the older people I know, they would have slipped in holy medals. They would have slipped in different things, thimbles in. The games that Ethan mentioned, I think it's lovely. It's one of the great things about Halloween. There's loads of fantastic things about it, I think, for me. But one of the little games you can play for your listeners, it's called the plate or the saucer game. So you get four or five or six plates out. You get a child and you blindfold them and you put different things on them. And each, then you spin them around a couple of times, and then you put your hand out, and whatever it lands in, kind of, it's going to predict your future for that coming year.
Yeah, well, I thought that was the whole point of the things that you found in the barn brack. Do you know what? People are just mad for stories about Loftus Hall. Let me bring in Rick Whelan here. Rick, you made the film about Loftus Hall that was, we're going back a little bit here now, aren't we? 1990s?
Yeah. Yes, early 1990s. It was a long time ago. But it was an enjoyable experience, Philip, you know, and scary sometimes.
Really? Why? What kind of a vibe did Loftus Hall give off to you back then?
Well, Loftus Hall has always given off a vibe. Anybody that goes there, there are some people who say, I don't get anything, it's just an old house. But most people feel something. And it's scary. If you're there on your own, it can be. And I stayed in the place many a night back then in the 90s when we were making the film. And only one night did I get spooked. And but otherwise, I haven't
go
been
on,
and I
go
didn't.
Go on, why? What spooked you?
I couldn't get to sleep, so I grabbed the Gideon's Bible out of the side locker and started to read it. And I was probably about 10 pages into it, because that usually knocks me out. You know, it's heavy reading at that time of night. I couldn't sleep. So I got out of bed and I walked across the room. And then, you know that feeling when you get off a plane, or it really happens as you get off a plane, say in Greece or any warm country, and they open the door of the plane, you feel the heat coming in on you.
Mm.
Well, it was the opposite of that. It was cold, freezing cold. Can't describe how much. I mean, maybe like 20 degrees below zero, something like that. And I just, I mean, it stopped me in my tracks, and I thought, what is that? Yet if you step back a few feet from it, temperature was normal. And it was a calm night. It wasn't a stormy night. There have been stormy nights in the Hook when Loftus Hall looks like
Wait,
it's covered
so did you,
in
did
snow.
Did you step in and out of it a couple of times?
Pardon?
Did you step in and out of it a couple of times to see hot, cold, hot, cold, hot, cold?
I did, of course, yeah. Well, you want to keep some rationale around you, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, no, I'm just letting my imagination go rampant here. And But it wasn't that. Whatever that was, I
There's
don't know.
No
I got out of the hall that night. No, and the stairs in Loftus Hall is one of the most famous stairways in Europe. It was carved in Italy, and it took 9 years to carve it in Italy and 4 years to install it in Loftus Hall. And it was installed by shipwrights. So that, you know, you genuinely, to use that, to coin that phrase, you can't get a razor blade between the jointing. It's astonishing.
Okay.
And so they would switch off the lights on the stairs at that time of the night, because you couldn't insure a stairway like this, because it's obviously insurance is based on the cost of replacement, and it couldn't be. It was priceless. And it still is. And will remain so, or probably just increase in price and value. But the lights were off on the stairs, and I couldn't get down. But the beam from the lighthouse, from Hook Lighthouse, was coming in about every 2.5 seconds or whatever. So I made my way out that way, got out the front window of the house, and I drove out the clappers. Home. And I live in Waterford, and I had to go around the long way because there's no ferries running in the middle of the night. But it was an astonishing experience. And I do tell it as it is, as it was. You can take it whatever way you want it. I'm not easily scared. I'd stayed in the place many times.
And with the benefit of hindsight in the years since then, do you chide yourself for your behaviour, or do you think, no, I acted rationally under the circumstances?
I think I acted reasonably rationally under the circumstances. Maybe if there was a few people with me. I remember one night somebody had offered to sit in the tapestry room. This is where the famous card game took place. And we wanted to stay there because they said, not a seance, but we wanted to see if there was anything. And I sat there, and we sat into the small hours of the morning, nothing, you know. Maybe ghosts don't appear when you'd like them to appear.
When the cameras are rolling, no, probably not. Oh, Rick.
Yeah, all of that. Yeah.
Great story. Thank you very much. I have to take a break, or I'll be haunted by the people in commercial sales in RTE.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
For the day that's in it, a reputable, one of the most reputable polling companies in the country asked Irish people, what is your greatest fear? They were given options like spiders, heights, failure, rejection, snakes, flying, enclosed spaces, the dark, and so on, and death. 30% said death. But you know what the greatest fear was? The thing that Irish people fear more than anything else, public speaking. This is not in our image of ourselves, I would have said, people. It's certainly not in the image that people from outside of Ireland have of us and our storytelling traditions, which we have been giving beautiful evidence of all afternoon long. Orla Carmody, communications coach. God, this is great news for you and the future of your business.
Hello, Philip. How are you? I'm not sure I believe it, but yes, it would be great for our business if it was actually true. I think I've worked with hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of people on their public speaking, and I don't recall anyone ever saying they feared it more than they feared death. They do fear it, and it's on a scale. Some people just get mildly anxious, and some people really do have a holy terror of it. But you know, you can always improve. I always say it's like going to the gym. Take your public speaking to the gym and work it out, and you will get better.
How bad were the worst people that came to you, Orla, and what did you do with them?
Well, I suppose you first of all have to get to the root of what is causing all the anxiety. Like, what are they afraid of? And very often it is kind of fear of letting themselves down in front of a tough audience, which may be, you know, the person who has to give the department talk at the company kickoff and the directors are over from the States or whatever. And they just have this holy fear that something they know very well, something they do regularly, is just going to fall flat in front of this important audience. So it's usually a fear of the sense of importance they attach to something. Or it could be somebody who, again, is quite comfortable speaking in front of a small group at the back of the office, but now they have to do a big keynote speech at a conference. And they sort of equate the numbers with the problem, and it's not. I always say to them, you're only ever speaking to one person at a time, so why is 1,000 people sitting there more daunting than 3 people sitting around?
And the other thing that they need to do in that situation, I suppose, is get over themselves, because the people are there to hear what it is that they have to say. They're not there to judge them and to look at them and to think about how they're composing themselves.
Absolutely. And, you know, it was just lovely listening to the earlier part of your programme there. And we are all Shanachies in this country. We are storytellers. And I always say to them, you know, if you draw a blank or something doesn't come out right, tell a story. Have a few stories or anecdotes or descriptions of whatever it is you're trying to say ready, and just drop into the story and watch your audience. Watch them all start smiling and nodding at you and giving you lovely affirmation, because the story will be so relatable. And it doesn't matter how serious the event is, how formal the talk is, every single person in that audience wants to hear a story, wants to hear an example of how it's going to work.
Absolutely. And can I say to that end, which may be controversial, I don't know, but I would have thought that PowerPoint presentations is the death of storytelling and good communication in this country anyway, because people stick rigidly to their slides and stop actually communicating and telling those stories.
Well, it's actually the real problem with the PowerPoint is that you're just not giving your brain enough work to do. So your brain starts ganging up against you. So if you're standing up giving a speech and you rely on those dense, wordy PowerPoint slides, all you're doing is reading. So then what does your brain do? It starts criticizing you. It starts saying, I wonder, should I have worn red today? I wonder, do they understand my Cork accent or my Donegal accent? I wonder, does my bum look big in this? You're focusing on the wrong place. You're entirely focusing on yourself. And there's nothing worse when you're actually listening to one of those awful PowerPoint presentations, when you hear the presenter starting to apologise for their own work, and that's when the wheels are really coming off.
Yeah.
And they start saying things like, well, I'm not sure now, can you see this graph? And we're all going, yeah, we can see it down the back here, so why is it on your presentation? Or they say, I think I might have too many bullet points here.
Oh, well, that's
yeah,
it. That's it. The death of any presentation. Don't worry, I haven't too many slides left. You say, sorry, I tuned out 4 slides ago.
Exactly. And we're all losing the will to live. And, you know, some people would say, well, you know, in our company culture, you have to use the slides. And you say, well, use them to an absolute minimum. Only use a few. Only put pictures up on them and a few words. Stop making them too dense and that people can't read them. And then get the comfort to drop away from the slide. Go back to your audience and say, now let me tell you why this is important to you. Let me tell you why we're actually giving you these figures for next year. And then, you know, when I was a salesperson myself, do you know what I used to do? And this is what the customer used to tell me. And again, the audience starts nodding and they're with you, because you're telling them why it's important to them. You're not just loading a load of facts at them and expecting them to work out to themselves why it's important.
All right. Well, Orla Carmody, thank you very much. Can you believe it, people? Not spiders, not heights, not enclosed spaces, not the dark, not snakes, not even death. It's public speaking. Oh, we need to get over ourselves, and I need to take another break.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.